You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat Satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219 from the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Innallazina amanu wallazina hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillah. Innallazina amanu wallazina hajaru wajahadu fi sabilillahi ulaika yarjuna rahmatan Allah ulaika yarjuna rahmatan Allah wallahu ghafurur rahim. يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الْخَمْرِ وَالْمَيْسِرِ قُلْ فِيهِمَا إِثْمٌ كَبِيرٌ وَمَنَافِعُ لِلنَّاسِ قُلْ فِيهِمَا كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men. And their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israeli forces killed more women and children in the Gaza Strip as the regime's violations of the ceasefire agreement continue unabated. And Iran strongly condemns a deadly terrorist attack in Australia, saying terror violence and mass killing must be condemned regardless of where they happen. Good day to you from Tehran and Bahman Radio. A senior Hamas official has slammed Israel's frequent violations of the Gaza ceasefire agreement, which have claimed the lives of hundreds of Palestinian civilians so far. Osama Hamdan said Israel's truce violations have left more than 400 Palestinians, mainly women and children, dead since the agreement entered into force. He stressed the movement reserves the right to respond to the occupation's violations. Hamdan noted that Hamas is in contact with the mediators regarding the negotiations for the second phase of the ceasefire, but the Israeli regime is doing its best to sabotage it. He also pointed to the deployment of an international force in Gaza. Hamdan said such a force must only act as guarantor for the implementation of the ceasefire agreement without any authority or contact with the Palestinian people. He stressed that Palestinians uphold their internationally recognized right to resistance, especially armed resistance. The official said resistance is a purely Palestinian popular decision, not a decision of Hamas. Our correspondent Robert Inlach has joined us earlier to discuss the future of the Gaza ceasefire agreement amid repeated Israeli violations. Here's what he had to say.
It's not really a ceasefire in the literal sense of that phrase. What it is a glorified pause. The Israelis needed a pause for a number of reasons. This came down to the growing PR front, the European and Arab initiative, which was launched at the United Nations General Assembly, whereby Saudi Arabia and France had put forth their New York Declaration on a Palestinian state, and a number of different diplomatic issues that they were facing. The United States saw this, presented a counterproposal, and also saw that the Israelis were failing to achieve their goals militarily on the ground, or at least their stated goals militarily on the ground through Gideon's Chariots 1, and then the second part to that operation, both of which proved to be failures. So Israel wanted to assess whether they could, during a pause period, implement new agendas to take over the Gaza Strip, to implement a plan of ethnic cleansing, and of course, to defeat the Palestinian national resistance. This is something that they've failed to do so far. They will very likely fail to do it in the future.
The Israeli regime continues to violate the Gaza ceasefire agreement with Hamas, killing and injuring more Palestinian civilians, mostly women and children. According to Palestinian Health Ministry, 5 civilians were killed in the latest strikes in Gaza. The new fatalities increased the number of Palestinians killed since the enforcement of the ceasefire to more than 390. Meanwhile, the regime's military vehicles opened fire on civilian homes in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. Local sources noted that the Israeli artillery also targeted eastern areas of the city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Earlier, the Israeli Navy abducted 4 Palestinian fishermen while they were fishing off the coast of Khan Yunis. The regime forces then blew up their boat. According to Palestinian officials, the regime's navy has killed around 230 fishermen since the start of the Gaza genocide, while abducting about 30 of them. The Israeli genocide in Gaza has killed nearly 70,700 civilians, mostly women and children, since October 2023, leaving over 171,000 others injured. The Israeli forces press ahead with their month-long military aggression against Palestinian refugee camps in the occupied West Bank, injuring civilians and demolishing infrastructure. In one of the latest developments, the regime forces issued a military order to demolish 25 Palestinian buildings in the North Shams refugee camp east of the city of Tol Karem. Palestinian officials condemned the move as an extension of the regime's systematic campaign of destruction and forced displacement of Palestinians into Al-Karam and Nur Shams refugee camps. They called Israel's new order a flagrant breach of the international law, urging the international community to intervene. Meanwhile, tensions escalated in the city of Al-Khalil, where Israeli settlers staged a provocative march east of the city as the regime forces closed several Palestinian neighborhoods. Local sources said the march began near the Kiryat Arba settlement. The Israeli forces tightened restrictions around the old city of Al-Khalil and the Ibrahimi Mosque, further heightening tensions. We earlier talked to our West Bank correspondent Nakahama to get the latest update on the ongoing Israeli atrocities across the occupied territory.
Let me start from the city of Tul Kerem, where in this evening the Palestinians in Tul Kerem have received military orders stating about the demolishing of 25 new residential buildings in Nur Shams refugee camp to the east of Tul Kerem city. This is a part of the ongoing military aggression that has been going on for almost a year now on Tul Kerem and also on Jenin refugee camp. Of course, we have covered last week that the Israeli forces are making military infrastructure inside Nur Shams refugee camps, roads, and permanent military points inside Nur Shams refugee camp, which indicates that the initial or the main intentions for the Israeli regime is to keep their presence inside these refugee camps that has been fully occupied by the Israeli forces. This actually and unfortunately exacerbates the atrocities and the ongoing suffering of the Palestinians in the northern part of the West Bank. We're talking about almost 60,000 Palestinians who have been forcibly displaced from inside these three refugee camps, Jenin, Tul Kerem, and Nur Shams refugee camp.
Iran has strongly condemned the deadly terrorist attack in the Australian city of Sydney, which left over a dozen people dead and many others injured. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei said, as a matter of principle, Iran condemns the violent attack against civilians in Sydney. He added that regardless of where they are committed, terror violence and mass killing shall be condemned. According to Australian officials, the attack was carried out by two gunmen, a 50-year-old father and his son. They opened fire at a Jewish event near Sydney's popular Bondi Beach, killing at least 15 people, including a child. One of the attackers was killed on the spot. Police said one gunman was a licensed firearms owner with six weapons registered to his name. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese described the attack as a terrorist incident targeting Sydney's Jewish community. The shooting is the deadliest in Australia since the 1996 Port Arthur attack, which left 35 people dead. Author and journalist Robert Fantino was with us earlier to discuss possible motives behind the terrorist attack in Australia. Here's what he said.
Australia, of course, has been a strong supporter of the Zionist regime since the genocide, before the genocide, but certainly since the genocide began in October 2023, and has not condemned Israel, the Israeli genocide at all. And unfortunately, the people that were victimized today at Bondi Beach were part of the, they might not have anything to do with it. However, there's so much hostility toward the Israeli government, Israeli regime, that these sorts of attacks are going to occur. And it's tragic and it's wrong and it's unfortunate. But as long as the Israeli government continues its genocide against the people of Palestine and also the crimes it's committing against the people of Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and so on, there's going to be this hostility. Now, that's unfortunately conflating anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, which it's unfortunate when people do that, and it is the Israeli government that should be criticized and sanctioned in any way possible. As long as the Israeli government, which purports to represent Jewish people around the world, which it does not, but the government spokesmen say it does, then there's going to be more hostility, more of these kinds of attacks. They're tragic and they're wrong, but as you said, they're understandable in a sense because people are angry at the Israeli government
It has been 10 years since Nigerian security forces launched an attack on the worship center of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and killed hundreds of members and destroyed property. Danjum Abdullahi filed this report on the anniversary of the gruesome incident known as the Zaria massacre.
This conference was one of the events organized to remember over 340 members of the Islamic movement who were murdered when soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked the home of Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and the worship center of the Islamic movement in December 2015. Participants at this conference described the 2015 Zaria massacre as a crime against humanity and of historic magnitude, which was committed by a few agents of the Nigerian state. Hundreds of men, women, and children were shot and buried in mass graves.
I lost 5 children, 3 of which are biological, 2 of which are adopted. They were orphans, and we took them in and were taking care of them. The 5 of them have not been found. Nothing about them were heard of. We just don't know how to explain the situation because of the excruciating pain in our hearts.
Mourners said that identity, faith, and religious conviction cannot be erased through violence. Speakers affirm that the Islamic movement is deeply rooted in an enduring struggle for justice and an unwavering resistance to tyranny, forces that cannot be silenced or extinguished.
The Zaria massacre made our call known to the whole world. Remember, in all continents of the world, there were demonstrations demanding our religion. We knew what happened. Remember, in India, it went to the extent that the Prime Minister of India was saying that, why don't you release that sacrifice?
A decade after the heinous massacre in Zaria, members of the Islamic movement continue to await justice and the prosecution of those responsible. Human rights organizations argue that the Nigerian government's attempt to conceal the atrocity reflects a profound disregard for human life and a blatant evasion of accountability.
We expected that indicted individuals and groups should be prosecuted, particularly the military commanders who gave the order. We also expected government, having been given the names and identities of the victim, to take steps towards restitution and compensation. Nothing has been done.
Participants at this conference said tyrants don't realize that abuse of power weakens their own system. They explained that moral leadership endures as the era of every political actor eventually finishes. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
South Koreans have joined migrant workers from around the world in Seoul to protest the government crackdown on violation of migrants' rights. The demonstration follows the death of a Vietnamese migrant worker who lost her life in an immigration crackdown. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
South Koreans, together with workers from around the world, marked International Migrant Workers' Day at Seoul Station on Sunday. Joining the demonstration was the father of a 25-year-old Vietnamese graduate of a South Korean university, Tu An, who died October 28th trying to evade an immigration crackdown.
The crackdown, which lasted over 3 hours, drove our daughter to her death. As a parent, I want to know the truth about what happened during her final moments on this earth.
The crackdown that claimed Tu An's life aimed to clean up the country prior to its hosting of APEC world leaders nearby.
All workers living in this land should be respected as human beings. No one should be forced to hide or run away in fear.
Nepali Udaya Rai came to South Korea 20 years ago. He suffered discrimination, workplace harassment, and unpaid wages, and says migrant workers' lives need consideration.
Neither employers nor the public understand the dire circumstances of migrant workers and often see them not as workers with rights, but as a temporary labor force to be used by capitalists.
There are about 1 million migrant workers in South Korea, and they do a large portion of the so-called 3D jobs, dirty, difficult, and dangerous. About 100 migrant workers are killed in workplace accidents here each year, and that's about four times the rate of South Korean workers.
Attitudes must change, says Udaya.
We must recognize migrant workers as fellow workers and members of society and strive together to protect their labor and human rights.
South Korean labor laws must also change, say critics, who point out that among other problems, visas for migrant workers essentially tie them to one employer, suppressing their wages, options, and human rights. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The Iraqi government has officially announced the end of UNAMI mission in the country after the visit of a general manager for the organization, Antonio Guterres, to Baghdad. The end of UNAMI's mission represents a transition to a new phase of balanced partnership with the United Nations based on respect for national sovereignty. Nawar Akabi reports.
A historic day in Iraq, as the Iraqi government officially announced the end of the mandate of the United Nations Assistant Mission for Iraq, UNAMI. After more than 20 years of its presence in the country, this comes in the light of improved security and political stability, which will allow Iraq to transition from direct international support to managing its own internal affairs.
In my view, the presence or absence of UNAMI mission makes no difference to Iraq, especially since this organization receives direct support. Unfortunately, most of the so-called international humanitarian organizations have turned into tools controlled by the United States. The evidence is clear. We have seen repeated interventions in Iraqi affairs. UNAMI had specific objectives, defined mandates, and legal and diplomatic mechanisms. But what we witnessed went beyond that, reaching direct political interference and intervention in Iraq's political decision-making.
Despite UNAMI's long presence in Iraq, political analysts believe the organization did not fulfill its true role. Instead, it influenced and interfered in political decisions, failed to manage affairs effectively, and consistently leaned toward the American side, failing to convey the suffering of the Iraqi people.
The truth is that the United Nations, through its representations worldwide in recent years, has failed miserably to be a clear mirror reflecting the suffering of people. Instead, it has turned into a tool in the hands of the United States of America. In Iraq, the UN representative reflected a specific agenda and exercised a form of imposed guardianship over the Iraqi state. As a result, the mission was only able to achieve the objectives pursued by the United States while attempting to place pressure on the Iraqi state.
This is a historic day for Iraq as UNAMI's mission ends and a new era begins, one characterized by the Iraqi sovereignty and the prevention of interference in internal affairs.
A new phase begins for Iraq with the end of the United Nations assistance mission in the country. This doesn't mean the end of cooperation with the UN, and is aimed at further asserting Iraq's sovereignty without any foreign intervention. Nawar Faik, Baghdad.
And that is a wrap for this hour's news. Thank you so much for staying with us.
The Ocean of Dua.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters in faith, dear listeners of RIB English Radio. You're listening to The Ocean of Dua. In the recent episodes of this program, we've been discussing and analyzing the supplication of Sabah. Let's listen to a passage of this dua and we'll be right back.
النفس والشيطان فقد وكلني خذلانك إلى حيث النصب والحرمان إلهي أتراني ما أتيتك إلا من حيث الآمال أم علقت بأطراف حبالك إلا حين
Okay, the passage that we just listened to from the supplication of Sabah states,
وَإِنْ خَذَلَنِي نَصْرُكَ عِنْدَ مُحَارَبَةِ النَّفْسِ وَالشَّيْطَانِ فَقَدْ وَكَلَنِي خِذْلَانُكَ إِلَى حَيْثُ النَّصَبِ وَالْحِرْمَانِ
How beautiful and how poetic these passages are.
Okay? If your help should forsake me in the battle against the soul and Satan, then your forsaking will have submitted me to where there is hardship and deprivation. Okay? We're all fighting our nafs, our carnal soul, our carnal desire, and Satan. Now, because, you know, Satan and his minions, shayateen, what they do is that they entice us, they encourage us to commit sins, and they try to have control over us, okay? But if we strengthen ourselves, if we rely on Allah, we will be able to resist their temptations. And that is what Allah has said in the Quran. Inna kayda shaytana kana da'ifa. The stratagem of Satan is weak. The tricks and the trickeries and the cunnings of Satan, they are weak. If we strengthen ourselves, yes, if we are weak ourselves, then they will overcome us. So here, we are asking Allah to strengthen us, to make us able to battle against both the nafs, the soul, and Satan. Because if Allah does not help us, then we're going to have a really, really hard time. And we'll be deprived of many good things if Allah does not come to our help. So, you know, and this supplication is showing how much we are reliant on Allah, how much we are dependent on Allah. Everything that we have is from Allah. Nothing is from us ourselves, okay? So if we see that we are on this path, if we are guided, if we have love for the Prophet and his Ahlul Bayt, if we are able to resist the temptations of Satan and his minions, these are all due to the Husn al-Tawfiq that we talked about in the previous episode. Okay? So it's important that we seek help from Allah to help us fight Satan. Let's take a break and we'll be right back.
If your help should forsake me in the battle against the soul and Satan, then your forsaking will have submitted me to where there is hardship and deprivation. My God, do you see that I have only come to you from the direction of hopes? Or clung to the ends of your cords when my sins have driven me from the house of union.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever.
Okay, the next passage of the supplication of Sabah reads, Ilahi, atarani ma ataytuka illa min haythul amal, amma'aliqtu bi atrafi hibalika illa hina ba'adatni dhunubi an daril wasal. My God, do you see that I have only come to you from the direction of hopes, or clung to the ends of your cords when my sins have driven me from the house of union? So, the thing is that we have two concepts in Islam that are very fundamental. One is khawf, one is raja. Khawf means fear. Fear of Allah's punishment. Fear of failure. Okay? And then we have raja, which is hope. Hope in Allah's mercy. Hope that Allah will help us, will guide us. Okay? We have been told that this khawfan raja, fear and hope, they should be the same, of the same weight. If you put khawf on one end of a scale and raja on another end, they should be equal. One should not be heavier than the other. So now, this passage is talking about wasal, dar al-wasal. What is that? Wasal means achieving something, achieving prosperity in the sense of seeing Allah, meeting Allah, encountering Allah. This is the wasal. Being united with Allah. This is what union is in the sense of mysticism. When we say wasal, we mean union with Allah. So here the supplicant is saying that I have many hopes. I have come to you from the direction of hopes, and I have clung to the ends of your cords when my sins have driven me from the house of union. So we are all trying to, rely on Allah, ask Allah to help us, that we might be actually failing. We might be drowning. And this is when we all scream for Allah's help. Oh Allah, help us. I'm drowning. Help me. I want to be united with you. I'm not satisfied with this state that I am in right now. Okay. And this is what this passage is trying to say, is that we all have hope in being united with Allah. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Ocean of Dua. Until next time, I leave you in the care and protection of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Wassalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, ya Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to Women of Resistance. 19-year-old Zahra Abdul Karim Mohanna had a single priority during the two-year genocide raging on them in Gaza. That is to protect her brothers and save their lives at any cost. Having lost her father, she preferred pangs of hunger than risk her brothers going to seek aid where scores of young men were targeted, disappeared, and shot. They have resisted the occupation and always will, Zahra says, but asks why they need to do that when the rest of the world is free. Here is more of Zahra.
Despite the history, occupation, and Gaza's classification as the world's largest open-air prison, by many who experienced its suffocating conditions, there was a semblance of a life. For young Palestinians like the one who shared her story with us, there was a rhythm to life, with the Israeli occupation simply the soundtrack. Building a future despite Gaza's situation was something that kept the next generation hopeful, studying, preparing, and working towards a day when there would be a different world. Israel's barbarity has replaced that with something utterly different. Life under genocide was a literal hellscape. The struggle to find something to eat outweighed by the psychological torture, in Zahra's case, of wondering if the occupation would martyr or take her brothers at any given moment. Activities once considered routine now took on an additional layer of jeopardy. Some of the sights witnessed are enough to change your very DNA, such as the tragedy playing out in real time. It's not just the obvious lack of regard for Palestinian lives. It's also the way in which Israel's genocide has changed even the landscape of Gaza. Orphans have been created, children forever scarred in an environment that is now completely alien, with all familiarity wiped from the face of the earth. Coming to terms with the new reality of Gaza has altered some things. There is no way the people, the ones who survived in any case, would not emerge unscathed. Though the one thing that has remained is the Palestinian steadfastness. It was terrifying how quickly Zahra's life, like the lives of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, became centered on the search to satiate hungry bellies. With such scarcity, finding sustenance would consume Gazan lives. Every day, Zahra checks in on the condition of her immediate family, a literal headcount, and then begins the soul-sapping business of making it through another day. The genocide has left those who have survived it physically absolutely spent. The new truce, or the so-called ceasefire, cannot be another false dawn. Something more just and lasting is needed. Palestinians are beyond tired.
Joining me today to discuss Zahra's story is Fatima Dosa, who is a pharmacist and a political activist. Welcome, Fatima.
Thank you for inviting me today.
Yeah. Fatima, you've spent decades, you know, advocating for the rights of Palestinians. I know you've been doing so many different kind of things, you know, over the years. We have watched Palestinian women, you know, generation after generation, suffering what Zahra is talking about. She's 19 years old, but this is not something that, you know, she's born into it. Her mother was born into it. Her grandmother's gone through it. Fatima, will this ever end?
It's a very important question, Sakina. You know, you're right in saying that throughout our lifetime, you know, in my 40th decade, and that's all we've seen. It's the same conversations and it's the same stories. And the endurance of Palestinian women and what they've suffered is because of the dispossession, the displacements, the occupation, the apartheid. And it can only end when justice is done. when they're no longer living in fear. You know, they're fighting for their, you know, what we're seeing in this genocide is they're fighting for their very existence. But I have every hope that this will end when Palestine will be free from the river to the sea. You know, as we are seeing, as the decades have gone by, their story has come more and more in the front. And we are seeing that the world has now woken up to the reality of what Palestine is, the dispossession, the occupation, and that Israel is now very much a pariah state. You know, the narrative has changed totally. And I have every hope that what we see in the liberation of Palestine, that it will not only be a dream that is whispered in the night, but it will be a lived reality for the Palestinians and for the women and the children that have gone through so much decade after decade.
Do you think it is this genocide that has created this momentum? I've said before, we've done processions for many, many, many years. But it would be, you know, when something happens, people go onto the street and then everybody forgets about it. You know, when we talk of the BDS, we boycott things for a while and then we go back into it. But do you think that has changed? Do you think the momentum in watching a live stream genocide has changed things?
You're right. Again, this is the first time that we are seeing a live stream genocide and that the social media has captured this. You know, sometimes we blame social media for a lot of bad things, but actually it is social media that has opened a lot of people's eyes to the reality, because what they have seen cannot be unseen. You know, a phrase that caught me once when I was listening to Butch Weir, who was had stood up for the vice president of the Green Party in America, was that we have to move from being a moment — what happened with George Floyd was a moment — but to make it into a movement. And now what we see is a movement. You know, the outrage that we have seen is organized. That even when the ceasefire was called, the march that happened was the biggest after the ceasefire was called. People could see through that ceasefire and the superficiality of that ceasefire, and that people out on the streets throughout the globe, in every strata of society, are committed to having that free Palestine and to stand in solidarity with the Palestinians, and to make sure that their future now is not decided by the imperialists and the colonizers, but by the Palestinians themselves, including the people who have sought to have armed resistance, because unfortunately this is the only way that we will see the liberation of Palestine.
Absolutely, Fatima. And I wanted to bring in the issue of the Gen Z here, you know, because we watch Zahra. Zahra is only 19 years old, but she speaks with, you know, she's grown up more than a year in these 2 years, the wisdom with which she's talking, you know, of how she first talks about all the difficulties she has faced, you know, the fear of losing her brothers. And then she says, we're not going anywhere. We're not going to make it easy for them. You know, our parents, our grandmothers have resisted, and today's women will resist. How is this playing out for the rest of the world, the Gen Z? We see huge movement among them. Are they seeking direct, you know, inspiration from women like Zahra?
Absolutely. I think from the whole of Palestinians, that, you know, we can see how the women have stood up, how the children have stood up. But even the men, sometimes even the men get forgotten in these. And I think what Gen Z is seeing is in the Palestinians is a clear, you know, moral clarity. They're seeing resistance, they're seeing resilience, and they're seeing the courage to stand up to the powers that be. And it's in their steadfastness, they're seeing not only the resilience and the resistance, but that even in the worst of times and in the darkest of times, that there is hope, and that you can stand up with compassion, with conviction. And you know, that is very apparent, that the Palestinians are not desperate.
Of course, along with the fact that, you know, not only are they brave, but their faith in God. You know, it's just astounding, because when they're going through the most difficult of times, you know, you will hear Hasbunallah wa Ni'mal Wakeel, which is such a strong faith. But finally, Fatima, we don't have much time left, but, you know, you run decolonization sessions. I want to quickly pick on that, because we've had, you know, some of our viewers saying that you should not be using the word colonization today, because for the white people who may not be colonized, who may already be on the side of resistance and pro-Palestinian, they feel like this is attacking white people around the world. What's your view on that?
It's an interesting question. It's a perspective I have to admit that I haven't really given much thought. But when I look at the reality out there, over the last 500 years, we are seeing imperialism and we are seeing colonization. You know, the colonization of lands may have gone, like I've grown up in Africa, but the colonization of our resources has not gone. The colonization of our minds have not gone. So it is a lived reality for many people that I feel the white people who may not be colonized and who can see through this have to understand that for majority of the world, colonization is what they are living with. And the face of that colonization is white supremacy and whiteness. So it's not something that we can just escape from. You know, we can't just say slavery didn't happen. We can't say apartheid didn't happen. It is a reality that for the people who are experiencing, it is very much a reality, and we have to understand that it is not something that we can just say.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, at least if there was no more colonization, then that's another issue.
Yeah.
But we're very much living, you know, absolutely, presently with all sorts of colonized, you know, aspects in our lives. And finally, Fatima, you know, talking about home here, you know, and our responsibilities, the Tories were horrible, but the Keir Starmer's Labour has proven to be even worse. Our country has been complicit, continues to be complicit in this genocide, you know. What do we do? What is our role?
I mean, you're right. You know, one thing that has the genocide what we've witnessed is a huge horror, but it's also very transformative, because what we've seen through that all the illusions of democracy, of rule of law, has fallen away. All the veils have gone. You know, the masks are off and the gloves are on, and it's important for us that this outrage is organized into a movement. And to make sure that the system, because you know, we come back to the fact that this is, whether it's Tories, whether it's the Labour Party, or whether it's the Liberal Democrats, it's the system that is an issue. But at the moment, we have to work in a two-pronged way. We have to work within the system to use their laws to make sure that we hold them to account, political account. So, you know, we make sure we don't vote for them, and that we have our own independent MPs. Legal accountability, that we are using international law to bring them into court, which is what, you know, a lot of organizations like Al-Haq are doing, to say that, for example, you cannot sell arms to a country that is committing genocide. So we should hold them to account. We should hold the leaders into account. And also the institutions that are like the media institutions, the NGOs.
Thank you all. We leave you with the sounds of Palestine by the artist Saif. Goodbye.
Thank you. insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, hello and welcome. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at some of the contents of Surah Ankabut. Brothers and sisters, now let's listen to the 45th verse of Surah Ankabut.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أُتْلُ مَا أُوحِيَ إِلَيْكَ مِنَ الْكِتَابِ وَأَقِمِ الصَّلَاةِ إِنَّ الصَّلَاةَ تَنْهَى عَنِ الْفَحْشَاءِ وَالْمُنْكَرِ وَلَذِكْرُ اللَّهِ أَكْبَرُ وَاللَّهُ يَعْلَمُ مَا تَصْنَعُونَ.
Recite, O Muhammad, what has been revealed to you of the book, and establish prayer. Indeed, prayer prohibits immorality and wrongdoing, and the remembrance of Allah is greater, and Allah knows that which you do.
So, dear listeners, this verse starts another section for us in our interpretation, in our discussion about this Surah Ankabut. So, this section, which could be called the fifth section of this chapter based on the different topics that have been mentioned, could be called the section that talks about how to argue in the best way possible. So, and this is the beginning of part 21 of the Quran, which is the Holy Quran is 30 parts or 30 juz, but this is the beginning of the 21st juz of the Quran. So, it says, "Utlu ma uhiya ilayka min al-kitab." Recite that which has been revealed to you of the book. وَأَقِمِ الصَّلَاةَ, and establish prayer. إِنَّ الصَّلَاةَ تَنْهَى عَنِ الْفَحْشَاءِ وَالْمُنْكَرِ. Verily, prayer keeps one away from indecency and evil. وَلَذِكْرُ اللَّهِ أَكْبَرُ, and certainly the remembrance of Allah is greater. وَاللَّهُ يَعْلَمُ مَا تَصْنَعُونَ, and Allah knows what you do. So in this verse, Almighty Allah's command to the Prophet ﷺ for reciting the Qur'an and establishing the prayer have come beside each other. And it is for the sake that Qur'an and prayer are two strengthening sources of actually power and iman and strength. So Allah, who informs his Prophet ﷺ of a heavy responsibility, tells him to take help from two strengthening sources to perform his heavy responsibility. So you see, if you are having a heavy responsibility, you should provide the one who is responsible with something with the items, with the materials needed. You cannot expect from one to do something magically, but yet not grant him with what he deserves, what he needs in the very first place. So, the Holy Quran in this verse says that if you want to be the Prophet, if you want to do your responsibility, what you need is two things. One is the recitation of the Quran, أُتْلُ مَا أُوحِيَ مِنَ الْكِتَابِ, and then establishing prayers. أَقِمِ الصَّلَاةِ.
أُتْلُ مَا أُوحِيَ إِلَيْكَ
والله يعلم ما تصنعون.
So, dear listeners, this verse, as we said, is saying that the Almighty Allah is informing the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam that you have a heavy responsibility, and you have to take help from these two strengthening sources for performing your heavy responsibility: recitation of the Quran and establishing prayers. Utlu ma uhiya ilayka min al-kitab, recite that which has been revealed to you of the book, wa aqimi as-salah, and establish the prayer. But at the end of different parts of the life story of the former nations and the actually great prophets, the unpleasant manner of the